This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Hope Kerwin. In 2018, the Center for Biological Diversity petitioned the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to list lake sturgeon in the United States as either endangered or threatened. Late last week, the environmental group announced plans to sue the federal government for failing to act on the original petition. In light of the most recent development in the case, we're bringing you a conversation from 2018 on lake sturgeon in the Mississippi River and other bodies of water in Wisconsin. Jeff Miller is a conservation advocate with the Center for Biological Diversity, and Doug Aloisi is project leader for the Genoa National Fish Hatchery, which works with several states and Native American tribes to restore lake sturgeon in the area. WPR's John Davis asked Jeff Miller to explain what's happening to the lake sturgeon.
It's somewhat analogous to what happened with the buffalo. We know that lake sturgeon were incredibly abundant historically. They, of course, occur in all the Great Lakes, the St. Lawrence River, Mississippi River Basin, and then in Canada and Hudson Bay and a lot of inland lakes and rivers. And we know that there were probably more than 15 million lake sturgeon in the Great Lakes alone in the late 1800s. And then, of course, commercial fisheries pretty much decimated the sturgeon runs. And they declined pretty quickly, starting in the late 1800s. Like I said, mostly due to overfishing, but also a lot of dam construction, which blocked their access to spawning and rearing habitat in rivers. Changes in water quality due to water pollution, and then a lot of just different ecosystem changes, habitat changes from water diversions, logging, conversion of land to agriculture, and channelization of rivers. So we're down to where we are now is we're down to lake sturgeon are at about 1% of their historical numbers. And given that this is a very long-lived species that takes a long time to mature till they breed, and they don't breed every year and have very, very limited success. It can take many, many decades to recover spawning populations. So we're looking at trying to get them protected to give us the tools to try to bring these fish back to some semblance of their former numbers and in the places where we can still do that.
This question is for either of you, and if you'd both like to chime in, that would be fine. But could you talk a little bit about the history and the makeup of lake sturgeon?
You mean the biology of
the species? The biology of the species, some of the history. They're a prehistoric fish, from my understanding. Doug, why don't you start?
Sure. It's very true that the lake sturgeon is considered a species of special concern in the to the Fish and Wildlife Service. And one of the reasons is their unique biology that actually takes them, as Jeff mentioned, a very long time to reach sexual maturity. And the females are normally at least about 22 years old when they first begin to spawn, and they only spawn usually their periodic spawner. They only spawn every 2 to 3 years because of the energy requirements it takes to form the ovaries back, and they're a very special fish and long-lived species, but also at the same time, we're talking about a fish that even if we have a great management plans and restoration plans, we're talking about restoring them generations into our future. We call them our legacy fish, something we get a chance to leave to future generations to continue to try to conserve.
What type of a fish are they?
They're called Acipenceridae or Polyodontidae is the paddlefish as well. They're a species that have a cartilage in them. They don't have an actual backbone. So maybe Jeff can elaborate on that a little bit.
One thing I'd point out also, this is a they of course are very iconic fish because they look so prehistoric and kind of ancient, and they truly are ancient. They've essentially remained mostly unchanged for 200 million years, so very successful species until they encountered modern humans. So they're bottom feeders, and they live in river habitats as well as lake habitats, and they're basically cruising along the bottom, suctioning up crustaceans such as crayfish and insect larvae, and then of course they you know, a lot of them spend time in some of the lakes, in the Great Lakes, and then they run up during spawning season. They run up the tributary rivers to lakes and spawning tributaries and rearing tributaries.
I know you mentioned, Jeff, they've been disappearing for quite a while, decades. Why now to file this petition?
Well, we've been kind of looking at lake sturgeon for a while. You know, this is a species that's gotten a lot of attention for restoration and conservation. There's an incredible amount of effort going into trying to bring these fish back with some degree of success on local levels. You know, everything from rearing sturgeon in streamside rearing facilities, reintroducing them to former habitats. There's efforts to remove some dams or make dams passable with fish ladders. So there's all kinds of restoration efforts going on. But really, you know, given the slow recovery, we feel that the Endangered Species Act is really going to provide the kind of tools that allow us to do a more wide-scale recovery efforts and planning for recovery. You know, there's a lot of states that currently list the sturgeon as endangered or threatened or special concern. Canada recognizes 8 distinct populations of lake sturgeon, and all of those are either listed as endangered or threatened or special concern. So really, this is an effort to try to jumpstart or kickstart more restoration using a very effective tool, the Federal Endangered Species Act. And the main reason is because the Endangered Species Act is good at recovering species, and it will be good for protecting habitat for sturgeon. And one of the ongoing threats that they face is proposals for construction of new dams, operation of existing dams and hydroelectric facilities. Obviously, they need very specific water flow and temperatures and conditions to spawn and rear. And those are pretty dramatically altered when there are dams involved in the spawning rivers.
Doug, the Genoa National Fish Hatchery, that's one of their missions, is to keep lake sturgeon stocked and bred. And could you talk a little bit about what all goes into that?
Currently, we are collecting eggs from 5 river systems. Sturgeon are kind of special, too, is that they tend to return to their natal rivers. They have a bit of a homing response where you can actually study the genetics of, say, a river population, and it'll be much distinct from other river populations that occur throughout the country. So we collect eggs from the local or locally available population so that we can restore the lake sturgeon populations as close geographically as possible, so they'll be able to hopefully be very very well adapted to the area that we're trying to recover them in. And we work with roughly about 3 different or 4 different Indian tribes or Native American tribes. And I should mention as well that these fish are very culturally important to Native Americans, and they were very important just as a survival tool for them in the spring, where they were recovering from a long winter. This was a very available source of protein for them to regain some of their energy sources from the winter. So
how are you doing at the job you're tasked with doing?
We're trying to use all the tools in the toolbox, so to speak, to recover these fish, whether it's from raising the fingerlings up to a 6 to 8 inch size to avoid predation. They have a unique also structure on them called a scute. It's a modified scale, which is hardened, so it's actually a deterrent to a lot of fish. They'll bite into them and then actually spit them out because of the hard surface they present to a predator. So once they get to about 6 to 8 inches, these scutes have very well formed, and their chance of being preyed on are much reduced. One thing, unique thing about sturgeon too is the females can have up to 250,000 eggs when they spawn, and they're just broadcast spawners over these river systems, and usually over cobble and gravel. And but there's a lot of predators out there eating them, and they don't give them any care. So that is also a survival technique for them to have that many eggs in a female.
I wanted to talk a little bit about the Upper Mississippi River. I know this petition, Jeff, as for endangered species protection or threatened in various parts of the Upper Midwest and really across the country, the central and the southern part of the country as well. In the Upper Mississippi River, they're believed to be threatened. Is that correct? Could you talk a little bit more about that, Jeff?
So our petition to the Fish and Wildlife Service, we asked for either a threatened listing for all lake sturgeon in the U.S., and we also asked the Fish and Wildlife Service to look into kind of the genetics and the population structure of lake sturgeon and determine if there are separate unique populations that could be listed on their own. So, because, you know, the fish are doing better in some places and worse in other places. You know, scientists are still really trying to figure out how different sturgeon populations are related. And Doug alluded to, a spawning run in one river can be very distinct from a neighboring river. For example, in Lake Michigan, studies have shown that all the, you know, the fish, obviously adult fish mixed in the lake in Lake Michigan, but then when they spawn, those fish that spawn in tributaries on the west side of Lake Michigan and Wisconsin are genetically distinct from fish that spawn in eastern Lake Michigan. So we really don't know, you know, I mean, it's possible that every river basin has its own unique run that may have very limited interbreeding with other, you know, sturgeon from other rivers. So that's something that will be looked at during the assessment of the petition and the whole potential listing process is, you know, what are the different populations. But, yeah, the Upper Mississippi River basin is one area we thought would probably be more endangered. Of course, in Wisconsin, you've got Lake Sturgeon and some of the tributaries of the Upper Mississippi and the St. Croix River, and then in the Yellow River, which is now isolated from the St. Croix population by a dam. And I know the Yellow River actually has potentially one of the larger remaining populations in the U.S., and then a couple of smaller populations in the Chippewa and the Wisconsin River. And again, you've got a lot of dams, like the Wisconsin River alone has 26 dams blocking the upstream sturgeon passage. And I mentioned the Yellow River, where it's those fish have been isolated from the St. Croix River by a dam. So that's a big issue also, is fish that maybe can spill over dams and go downstream, but adults can't get back upstream. So you've got these isolated small populations.
Jeff, what is the difference between an endangered and a threatened species?
Well, an endangered is a species that's likely to go extinct in the near future if there weren't protective measures in place. And the threatened species is one that is essentially not there yet, but is on a trajectory, in the future, has a downward trend, enough threats that if they aren't addressed, it will in the future become endangered. And from a regulatory standpoint, there's not a lot of difference in terms of federal listing, except that for threatened species, there's a little more latitude to allow take or harm or harvest of a threatened species if there are management plans and conservation measures in place. So the threatened species gives a little more latitude to, for example, if the state of Wisconsin has a fishing harvest plan in place that the Fish and Wildlife Service determined was, you know, consistent with recovery of the species, then that could be permitted in. Same with if there are tribes that have cultural harvest and along with conservation and restoration that's consistent with recovery, those could be permanent and also. So that's the essential difference.
You're listening to Newsmakers on Wisconsin Public Radio La Crosse. I'm John Davis. We're talking about the demise of the lake sturgeon around the country, including the Upper Mississippi River and Great Lakes and many other waters across the country. Our guests are Genoa National Fish Hatchery Project Leader Doug Galluisi and Center for Biological Diversity Conservation Advocate Jeff Miller. The center recently petitioned the U.S. Fish and Wildlife to add lake sturgeon to the endangered species list. Jeff and Doug, I'm wondering if you could both speak to this. Are lake sturgeon sought after fish?
There's a number of different open fisheries in Wisconsin. We are really blessed with a couple of stable river systems that have a population that can sustain harvest, and it's managed by the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. One of them is the spear fishing season over on Lake Winnebago, which is a highly popular and it's also highly sought after to get sturgeon tags as well for that. It's very highly regulated by Wisconsin, and they really know that population, have researched it for years, and have some great biological data from that fishery, actually, as far as life history and age and growth. Then there, you can also fish hook and line if you petition the DNR for a tag as well on the Wisconsin River, and there's a short season over there as well. So there's a few opportunities out there, and then there's a few states that allow catch and release fishing as well. But I guess the main attractant for sturgeon species is obviously the caviar industry, and you asked if there's a demand for them as far as that goes. That's a huge demand, and they also are very good to eat, from what I understand, as well. So,
Jeff, from what you know, are there regulations on the caviar industry?
I don't think lake sturgeon are used domestically anymore for caviar production, and I know there were in the past exports. I think most of the lake sturgeon for caviar is coming out of Canada, and I think that's pretty limited these days also. I know it has been a concern in the past. And one in the same vein, one concern is poaching, because there is so much money to be made with caviar, and because a lot of the sturgeon species in Russia and in other places are so depleted, people are turning to using sturgeon in North America for that. But I don't think there's much of a legal commercial caviar trade in lake sturgeon. I don't think it's very minimal still in Canada.
No, I should clarify. I was talking about the sturgeon as the species, not the species, but the family, as opposed to lake sturgeon.
Yeah. Yeah.
Doug, you mentioned licensing that's needed. Are there bag limits?
Very
strict bag limits on
very strict
lake sturgeon?
Yes, I believe it's one per person at each location. The Wisconsin DNR. And then they also have a what's called a sturgeon watch program. When the fish swim up into these natal rivers to spawn in the spring, they can be vulnerable in these shallow systems, but they have volunteers that actually watch the pods of lake sturgeon to make sure that to reduce the chance of poaching going on at that vulnerable time.
Is that the same thing nationally, Jeff?
Wisconsin, like Doug said, does have one of the better, maybe even the best remaining lake sturgeon population in the Lake Winnebago system, which that includes also, you've got them in the Fox River and the Wolf River and Lake Plagan. That is a very well-regulated fishery, but the season is very short. It's a very small number of fish. The other sport fish harvest in some of the inland, there is a little bit of concern in areas where there's sport fishing is still allowed, where the populations are small. And I guess I'd call out maybe the Chippewa River, portions of the Wisconsin River, and Yellow Lake, where, and maybe even St. Croix River, where you've got pretty small or depleted populations, and there's still potential for harvest. A lot of places there is catch and release, and that doesn't seem to be much of a concern. One other thing to look into, though, is there also is harvest in Wisconsin of shovelnose sturgeon, and you know, there's some similarities in the species, so there's certainly should be looked at. If there's, I know in some other states there's been people catching, you know, catching what they thought were shovelnose or other non-protected sturgeon, and so need for education and make sure people aren't misidentifying and inadvertently harvesting lake sturgeon in areas where their numbers are depleted.
Doug, when you go to a river and do some work, how does that play out, or what do you do when you're working to restore lake sturgeon populations?
Normally, during the egg collection anyway, we always work with a great group of partners, and it's the management agency that has the control, so to speak, over the population and manages it. For example, in Wisconsin, we, with the help of the Wisconsin DNR, they do a lot of age and growth and length studies at that time. And during the collections of for their length weight studies, at the same time, we collect milt and eggs from the males and females and fertilize them bankside and disinfect them to make sure that there's no diseases that we're bringing back to the hatchery, and bring them back and incubate them, and then raise them to the juvenile size. So we also assist in running a streamside rearing unit on the Michigan side of the lake, the Kalamazoo River, and that's with partnership with Michigan DNR and the Gun Lake Tribe over there to restore that small river population inside a streamside rearing unit.
What is the size limit that people can take in lake sturgeon? I mean, how big do they have to be before you can legally harvest them?
I know for the sport harvest, it's 60 inches or larger.
So how old is a fish that's 60 inches long?
Generally, they're considered adult at around 45 inches. So, I mean, I would just a guess, I'd say several decades probably to get to 60 inches. And, of course, these are fish that can live up to 100 years old, so and get up to 8 feet long. But, yeah, at 5 feet, I would guess 3 or 4 decades old.
What are you putting back in the water? What size lake sturgeon?
They're roughly 6 to 8 inches long, and we do that in the fall of the year, roughly about September, October. And depending on the location that we're trying to restore the animals to, it's anywhere from, you know, a 4 or 5 hour drive to a 20-hour drive to the St. Lawrence River Basin.
So you're breeding them and growing them at your facility in Genoa, and then taking them to the wherever you're going to put them in the water.
Yes, yeah. Exactly.
What kind of monitoring goes on then of these fish? Are they monitored at all?
They sure are. Yeah, we they're monitored twice for fish health assays to make sure that they're not carrying any infectious diseases either to the hatchery or into the stocking area. So we're looking for things such as, you know, viruses and bacteria that may be detrimental to not only to the sturgeon, but also to the river systems that we place them in.
Doug Aloisi is the project leader for the Genoa National Fish Hatchery. Joining him is Jeff Miller from the Center for Biological Diversity. Today we're talking about a petition the center filed in 2018 with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to place the lake sturgeon on the endangered species list. Late last week, the environmental group announced plans to sue the federal government because it has failed to act on that request. Coming up, we'll continue our conversation. You're listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Hope Kerwin. From Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse, this is Newsmakers. I'm Hope Kerwin. Despite ongoing efforts to increase the number of lake sturgeon in the Upper Mississippi River and other bodies of water, populations of the prehistoric fish keep dwindling. Late last week, the Center for Biological Diversity announced they're suing the federal government for failing to act on a petition to protect the fish. Last summer, WPR's John Davis talked with Doug Aloisi from the Genoa National Fish Hatchery and Jeff Miller from the Center for Biological Diversity about the problem. In this encore presentation of the show, Miller explained the Endangered Species List process.
So the Endangered Species Act, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service can based on information it has, can propose species for listing, either as threatened or endangered. Or citizens can submit petitions. And so the petition we submitted, we basically talked with scientists. We looked through all the literature and all the published information from state agencies and tribes and federal agencies and assembled all that information, talked about the life history, the range, the status, looked at population trends, tried to identify everywhere that sturgeon occur and how the populations are doing, discussed quite a bit about the genetics and the potential makeup of, you know, what is a population of lake sturgeon, which is still kind of developing science, and looked at what's the existing management, what are states doing, and is, you know, if we do nothing and don't list them, is that going to be adequate to recover the species? And after our kind of assessment, we felt that the Endangered Species Act protections pretty much are required to recover the species, just given the long time frame and all the different threats that they still face. But you know, the overfishing is really what was kind of the big blow to lake sturgeon that depleted them, but they still face a lot. And overfishing is not really an issue anymore, but they do face a lot of other threats. And I'd say the biggest thing we can do to bring back lake sturgeon is address all of the dams that are on the various tributaries and rivers. If you look at the Great Lakes alone, there's more than 7,000 dams on tributaries, and only about a third of those are passable for fish. Upper Mississippi River's got 37 locks and dams on it. So, you know, these fish are either fragmented and isolated because the dams prevent them from moving, or they're blocked in a lot of these rivers pretty close to the lakes. So they're migration barriers. And that, of course, you know, the vast majority of historic lake sturgeon habitat is not accessible to adult fish anymore. So, and then, of course, the flows that are allowed to bypass the dams, you get a lot of altering of the river ecology, water quality issues, and then fish also get stuck or entrained. A small fish can get trapped in some of the water diversion structures. So addressing the impacts of dams, removing some dams where it makes sense and is feasible, providing fish passage through fish ladders at other dams, and making sure that the bypass flows at these dams where there are lake sturgeon spawning below them are adequate for all their life stages.
Jeff, to my knowledge, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service doesn't deal with dams. That's more of a U.S. Army Corps of Engineers function.
Right.
So
right.
How do you get at that? You know, you're petitioning one agency that's, from my understanding, trying to save this species, and you're really trying to get at another agency that you feel is doing the harm here. How do you get at that issue?
Yeah, so a lot of the dams we're talking about are federally licensed. There's a federal process, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, or FERC, and so any hydroelectric power dams are going to be under that FERC permit. or other dams. Yes, they're going to be operated or permitted by the Army Corps of Engineers. Once a species is federally listed under the Endangered Species Act, that triggers a much higher level of review of approval of new dams, reoperation of existing dams, and the FERC process, the federal dam process. A lot of these dams, when they give them a permit, it's for 30, 50 years often. So there's not a lot of opportunities to revisit the conditions that those dams are operating under. And a lot of dams actually are, the FERC licenses are being renewed now or coming up in the future. So having an Endangered Species Act listing would be very, very important during that federal dam renewal process. Because we've been looking at the current renewal process, and it's really inadequate for dealing with fish passage for lake sturgeon. A lot of these dams that have been licensed have been renewed in the last 10, 15 years. Some of them have provisions for lake sturgeon. A lot of them don't address them at all. Or if they do, it's pretty much optional if the fish isn't federally protected. So lake sturgeon are kind of getting the short end of the stick in these dam renewal processes, and that would dramatically change if they were to be listed as threatened or endangered.
Doug, I'm hoping you can answer this question. What do government agencies do when they are petitioned like this?
First of all, I guess I should give my disclaimer here that I am not representing the Fish and Wildlife Service in the listing recommendation or disapproval process here. I'm trying to represent what we do down at Genoa as far as lake sturgeon restoration, but I will answer your question. Normally, it causes the agency to try to gather all of its experts and ongoing management efforts for the particular species. Usually forming a team, whether it's if it's a fish listing, the fisheries team will form usually in the lead region, which in this case would be most likely the Region 3 in Minneapolis. And then we'll work closely with our endangered species branch as well to formulate, I don't want to say defense because we're both on, we're all on the same team.
Sounds
really.
Sounds like you're on the same team.
Yes,
now.
It would also allow us to make educated and scientific response, whether it would be yes or no, to the petitioning agency. So it's a kind of a gather the forces and use whatever science is available to respond to the request.
Wanted to add to that, if the Fish and Wildlife Service does accept the petition, it triggers Doug referred to. It's basically a year-long status review process, and that would involve the Fish and Wildlife Service would actually go to state agencies and to tribes, anyone who's involved in management, and get their input. And then there would actually be a public comment period. There'd be potentially public hearings. And then after that year-long status review, they would come out with a proposal. They'd either say, well, we don't think it warrants listing, or maybe these populations warrant listing, or yes, we think it does. And they would put out a proposed rule, which would actually then trigger another round of public comment. So there's going to be, if this does move forward, there's going to be a lot of opportunity for the public and for state and local agencies and tribes to weigh in and provide information.
Has your organization been working with tribes on this? And if so, what is their response? It sounds like lake sturgeon are very important to their culture, and they don't want to see them go anywhere either.
Yeah, we have not worked with the tribes. We did notify. We tried to identify every tribe that we could determine was either managing or doing any kind of restoration with lake sturgeon. And we did notify them that we were petitioning and that they, just so they know that this process is starting and so they have an opportunity to provide information. I guess the biggest question I know I got from some of the tribes that are working on sturgeon was, would this have any impact on tribal harvest? And I guess our answer is it's unlikely. We don't know of any current tribal harvest that's considered a threat to lake sturgeon populations. And many tribes are very active in reintroducing lake sturgeon and promoting recovery of these fish. So given that the Fish and Wildlife Service is required to consult and coordinate with the tribes, and there actually is a provision that the listing could not infringe on tribal rights. So I think, getting the tribes involved early and making sure their concerns and their, traditional harvest is considered. And we certainly would support continuing traditional harvest and continuing the restoration activities that the tribes are doing. One thing I would say is if the species was to get listed, funding and resources do tend to flow towards protected species. So it actually, I think, would probably increase funding potentially for tribes for sturgeon research and management. And then the Fish and Wildlife Service can also work with the tribes to do resource management plans that can be approved and actually permitted into the listing. So they would be allowed to potentially continue harvest, and it would be protected under the list.
You're listening to Newsmakers on Wisconsin Public Radio La Crosse. I'm John Davis. We're talking about the demise of the lake sturgeon around the country, including the Upper Mississippi River and Great Lakes and many other waters across the country. Our guests are Genoa National Fish Hatchery Project Leader Doug Eloisi and Center for Biological Diversity Conservation Advocate Jeff Miller. Jeff, I know the petition is a federal petition, but do you work individually with states as well, and is there some type of protection that each state can provide for the species?
Yeah, there are a number of states that do list the species as endangered or threatened. However, the states, most of the management with the states involves fishing regulation. They do sometimes get involved in, there's habitat issues, certainly on state lands or state-managed waters, but really, if you want to address habitat issues and get into the federal agency management actions, like I said, the dam relicensing, or permitting new dams, or deciding how much flow is going to go through past dams, those are all federal processes, and you really have to have the federal listing to influence those and change those processes for the better. So. State listing is important, and some states are very protective of their lake sturgeon. A number of states have written management and recovery plans. Of course, Wisconsin is one of them. Plan that was finished, I think, in 2002 to plan for making sure we keep these fish around. But you get a patchwork of efforts. There's some states where there's no protection at all. There's other states where they're endangered, and federal protection again just gives a higher level of protection and more tools for addressing what I see as are some of the most significant impacts.
Jeff, could you talk a little bit about the general work of the Center for Biological Diversity?
We're a national group that works to protect endangered species, but really all wildlife, charismatic megafauna like the lake sturgeon down to insects and kind of the unlovable little critters. And we're really concerned with making sure we keep a diversity of our native wildlife around for future generations. So we do a lot of work trying to get species that are imperiled and are clearly in decline protected, whether that's through the Federal Endangered Species Act or through state protections. And then we do a lot of work on protecting our public lands, making sure they stay in public ownership, that people have access to them, and that our wildlife and natural resources on public lands are protected.
Doug, could you talk a little bit about the work you're doing at Genoa? I know while lake sturgeon is one of your focuses, you have many other focuses as well.
Our mission dovetails the Fish and Wildlife Service mission as well it should, which is responsible for recovery of threatened and endangered animals, whether they swim or they or their mussels. We do a lot of work with freshwater mussels, which is one of the most endangered fauna in North America. We work with four endangered species there right within our own upper Mississippi River Basin. And fish hatcheries are kind of a great tool as far as mussel restoration, because mussels actually use a fish as a host to complete their life cycle. They live on the gills and skin of fish for anywhere from 6 weeks to 6 months, depending on the species. So we have a great source of fish just at our fingertips to be able to use in mussel restoration as well. So they kind of complement one another. We also raise a number of fish for fisheries management on tribal and federal waters. Of course, fish populations restoration is a big goal of ours as well for fish that haven't been listed yet, but either need our species of concern at the, or it looks like they are more rare over their native range than they have been, like lake trout and coastal brook trout.
You were mentioning before we got started that the coastal brook trout has gone through this being on the endangered species list. I'm curious, are mussels as well, certain mussels you're working with?
Those actually, the ones that I listed as endangered, had gone through a review process. But as Jeff alluded to, they're not charismatic megafauna, so there wasn't quite a push, say, to list a mussel species. And plus, the fauna itself is so endangered that it's really hard to pick and choose ones that are in decline, because they're all in various stages of decline due to habitat loss and other effects that's going on in the river system, so that may even affect lake sturgeon as well. So those are our main focuses right now, but we also raise, like we were talking about, coastal brook trout for tribal restorations, and we raise about 18 species of fish down there, and about that same amount of mussels as well. So,
is water quality in the upper Mississippi River, for example, a reason why lake sturgeon are declining?
I would say historically it was a cause for historic decline. With the passage of the Clean Water Act and you know, a lot of efforts, ever since we decided it wasn't okay for our rivers to catch fire, and we started trying to clean up pollution and manage pollution sources into rivers, and people, you know, became aware that everything that happens in a watershed, and, you know, eventually ends up in the river. I think you know, most of the even in the Great Lakes, certainly there still are pollution problems, and certain pollutants are still a problem, especially pollutants that are airborne and will be deposited, you know, through the air. But we as a society have done a very good job of reducing pollution in rivers. We've got a long ways to go, obviously, but I would say it's no longer a major cause of decline for sturgeon. That said, there are specific industries and certain chemicals that may be of concern. But I would say sturgeon are swimming obviously in a lot cleaner water than they were even 40 years ago.
Doug, you go to work every day on the banks of the upper Mississippi River. What is the water quality like in general?
We've changed, obviously, the landscape just by human actions, of course, whether they be farming or runoff due to, say, paving or those type of things where you get stormwater runoff. Like Jeff said, there's work to do. Some of the, you know, what they call non-point source pollution, such as, whether it be agricultural influenced, really are seen down in the Gulf of Mexico with the, they call the dead zone down there. That doesn't necessarily affect the lake sturgeon populations. It's a little bit too far south, but it does definitely affect the Gulf and the lower river. So it's just a matter of being really, cognizant and try to maintain our topsoil where it is right now and to do the best thing we can to for our aquatic resources as well by whether it's design of new parking lots and that using different technologies to keep water where it's supposed to be, whether it's in the wetlands or to be able to be filtered before it hits the river.
Sturgeon, because they do, you know, they accumulate a lot of these toxins, so it is still a concern. And a lot of these, like I said, are kind of legacy pollutants. Certainly, mercury and dioxin is one of the concerns. Because of the way they feed and the fact that they can accumulate these toxins, it's a concern. And one thing I do want to call out that is a potential issue for lake sturgeon is the boom in crude oil transport. And we've got a lot of crude oil that's being transported on trains, and these train oil shipments are pretty rapidly increasing. And a lot of those tank cars are going over the Mississippi River and tributaries along the Great Lakes and rivers throughout the Midwest. And there is a growing likelihood that we're going to start having more spills. And then in addition, there's also pipelines that go across some of the lakes. Lake Michigan in particular has a crude oil pipeline that has had quite a number of spills and spilled oil into, for example, the Kalamazoo River. And so that's actually a threat that's still out there and is probably increasing. It's just a matter of time, I think, before we have a significant oil spill in a lake sturgeon stream. So.
Who makes the final decision if lake sturgeon are added to the endangered species list?
The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. It's a pretty long process. So there's what they call a 90-day or an initial finding, where they review the information, the petition, and they decide if there's sufficient information that that listing should be considered, and then that will trigger a year-long status review with public comment and input from states and tribes. And then at the end of that process, if they decide it should be listed, they will do a proposed rule, and there will be another opportunity for public comment and input. So it's a at least a couple-year process. And then if the lake sturgeon were to be listed, it's possible that the service could list the entire species in the U.S., or they could determine that there are distinct populations, for example, Upper Mississippi River or Ohio River Basin, or they could potentially list a Western Lake Michigan population. That still has to be determined. And then once it's listed, there's a couple other tools that are available for helping to protect and recover the species. And one of these is designating critical habitat. So that's identifying the lake and stream habitat that's needed to protect and recover the species, and that would add a layer of protection, but only for federal lands and federal activities. So any federal permit or any federal funding or anything that happened on federal land would have to consider that habitat, an extra level of protection. And then the final tool, and a very important tool, would be a recovery plan, a federal recovery plan. And we looked at all the listed species in the U.S. that have recovery plans, and species that get a recovery plan are twice as likely to recover and eventually come off the endangered species list. So twice as likely as species that don't have a recovery plan. And that's basically a roadmap for, the next, this is a species that's going to take many, many decades to recover, but it would be the roadmap for what actions would have to occur how to get us to where we've got lake sturgeon populations that can sustain themselves into the future without our intervention. And it's going to be a challenge given climate change, and we've got all kinds of ecosystem changes going on because of invasive species, and so we've got a lot of work to do.
Doug, this is a big part of what you do at Genoa, is try to work to protect lake sturgeon populations. Can more be done, do you think?
I think more can always be done. Of course, usually when you put a focus on one species or concentrate efforts on one, then another species would tend to suffer unless more funding obviously came into the picture. But obviously, like Jeff was saying, there's a benefit to being on the Endangered Species Act and having a recovery plan, and actually having propagation as a recovery tool in the plan. That's what activates our role, is when someone writes a plan that mentions a specific propagation action that would benefit the species.
Doug Aloisi is with the Genoa National Fish Hatchery, and Jeff Miller is with the Center for Biological Diversity. They talked with WPR's John Davis last summer about efforts to protect the lake sturgeon under the Federal Endangered Species Act. And that's Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Hope Kerwin. The executive producer for Newsmakers is John Gatto, and our senior news editor and producer is John Davis. If you missed part of today's show, you can find the audio archives at wpr.org/newsmakers.